welcome to Change Surfer Radio. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we present a sexy high-tech vision of our radically democratic future. Today we'll be speaking with Jim Dater. He's a professor of political science at the University of Hawaii, director of the Hawaii Research Center for Future Studies, president of the World Futures Studies Federation, author of several books on the future of political institutions. Welcome, Professor Dater.
Thank you.
The idea of the future of our democratic institutions, when most futurists have addressed this, one idea that comes up very often is that electronic democracy will somehow revolutionize what we're doing. Are you taken with this idea? That
yes, very definitely. I think that the movement from representative democracy to direct democracy is already well underway, for good or for ill.
And what's it going to look like when we have more representative, more participatory democracy through electronic institutions?
Well, I know what I would like it to look like. I'm not sure I know what it will look like.
Right.
First of all, I have tremendous faith in the ability, people's ability to govern themselves and to participate in things that are of interest and importance to them. The current system of government in the United States especially is designed to prevent people from participating in any direct way in making policy. And therefore, people spend their time doing other things, for the most part, instead of focusing on governance. But if you look at the way many people take to participating, let's say, on the Internet, I think you can see in that a way in which direct democracy might be able to be developed.
So people would log in to their cable TV through their cable modem and be able to vote? Is that what you're thinking?
Well, it's more than that. I think we need to think of democracy as more than just the input into policymaking, which would be voting on issues. But I do think that people should have a right to gain information, understandable information about issues of importance, to talk these issues over with their friends and relatives, and then to participate in voting with safeguards, just as we have safeguards in place through a constitution and through our current representative system, to not have what might be called mobocracy or voting by fads or persuasions. There's lots of fine-tuning that has to be carried out. But basically, yes, I do believe people can vote intelligently and should be allowed to vote directly on issues of importance to them. But let me just say, there's more to democracy than just making policy. There also has to be something that I call direct administration or direct bureaucracy. That is to say, the carrying out of that policy also has to be, people have to be directly involved in that as well.
So this goes beyond C-SPAN. The carrying...
It most definitely goes beyond anything we have at the present time.
Mm-hmm.
It goes back, if you will, to the way life was like in traditional small tribal societies, but just on a high-tech level.
So the making of everything transparent, all the mechanisms of government.
Absolutely right. And again, it's not requiring people to participate in things that are not of interest to them, but it does allow them, if they want to participate directly, they can do so. So that there is a possibility that you would link direct democracy with a representative government, with each individual having the right to take over from her representatives and vote directly on those things that are of interest to her.
Another idea that's been along in the futurist bailiwick is world governance or world government. Do you think that this extension of our ability to participate and to know about things on the other side of the planet will make more possible the creation of global citizenship and a global polity?
Even though that's a very un-American idea at the present time, extremely unpopular, no one talks about it in the political discourse positively, I think it's absolutely necessary. We have a global economy, we have a global environment, we have a global media, we have global sports, we have global everything except governance. We don't have a way to influence the direction of all these other things. So global governance is absolutely necessary. At the same time, I think that nation states, as currently structured, are both too small to operate at the global level and too big to operate at the local level. So I think we need a form of government that is both more decentralized and local and more global, and that's something that we don't have at the present time.
Do you think that the current United Nations, the reform of the current United Nations, is a vehicle for that, or do we really need to replace that by?
Oh, I definitely think it needs to be replaced. First of all, I do think that the United States should pay its dues, both the United Nations, and rejoin UNESCO and be part, at least, of that body. But the United Nations itself is profoundly wrong for the future of governance, because it does privilege the nation state. And as I said, that's on the way out.
Now, you've written poignantly about the fact that Tofflerism, as one of the major strands of future thinking, was co-opted by conservatives, and Gingrich in particular, and the kind of tragedy of that. The futurism in the past used to be pretty much the domain of the left, and future speculation was often utopian. And it seems to have tilted towards a kind of corporate and military focus over the last 50 years or so. Is there still a strain out there? You seem to represent a strain of relatively progressive futurism. Is there an undercurrent that I'm missing out there?
Depending upon when one really says the modern futures movement began, and I would place it after the Second World War,
Okay. Maybe
at the latter strains, you have to say that it began with the military. It began with the RAND, before it was the RAND Corporation, when it was part of the Air Force, trying to forecast the consequences of saturation bombing on Germany and Japan, and to think about how to control the world afterwards. So there has always been in modern futures movement a concern with those elements in our society who must and do take a long-range view, and that's most certainly the military. And yet at the same time, the futures groups that got together after the Second World were in a sense divided on the one hand between the World Future Society, which is an American organization that's headquartered in Washington, D.C. and frequently holds its meetings there, that in a sense grew out of the establishment, and don't want to say right wing, but at least thoroughly to the establishment view of doing things.
A lot of corporate consultants are.
Yes, absolutely right. And the World Future Studies Federation that you mentioned, I've been involved with for a long time, which really began in Europe by people who said, what's wrong with Western civilization, which has had two world wars, a depression, had Hitler trying to exterminate people on the basis of ethnicity. What's wrong with Western civilization? Can't we do better? So they have been a cultural future studies, concerned for the most part about people who don't have an opportunity to have their visions of the future heard or taken seriously because the media and the corporations and everything else dominate it with their view.
So it's really a division between American and European futurism?
I would say that's true, only because America is the dominant hegemon in the world today, and its ways of doing things are globally dominant.
Well, when I teach political sociology, I break things down for students in terms of economic liberal and conservative and cultural liberal and conservative. And there's been, for the last 100 years or so, in most countries, a broad alliance between economic leftists and cultural libertines, and on the other side, cultural conservatives and economic conservatives, or economic liberals, depending on how you frame it.
Right.
And do you think that this way of looking at things is going to break down? Do you see new frames for political left-right or political division in the future?
Yes, I do. First of all, I think that there is a gradual but ultimate reevaluation of the role of Marx, which, of course, never really had a chance to get operating anywhere in the world, not in Russia, not in Eastern Europe, not in China, not in North Korea. And so Marxism is a wave of the future, most certainly, as an ideology at least, and as a way of looking at the world, understanding the world. But more than that, I would say if you look at the Republican Party, to just the current Republican Party, just in the categories you described, it is an extremely untenable balance between the religious right and the cultural right, and people who are in favor of globalism in economic and all other spheres. And so on the one hand, you have protectionists and folks that want to hold on to certain values linked precariously with the people that are really destroying those very values through their economic activities. I just don't see how much longer that can hold together.
Hmm. So you think that the Republican Party at least is going to crack apart along those divisions?
Yes, I do. I think it is cracking apart, and it's the fact that maybe Bush can bring it together. I'm not so sure that's going to happen. Anything could happen given the lunacy of our political system at the present time. But it seems to me that the Republican Party is in serious problem.
Do you think a third party is a possibility in the States? Or?
It's absolutely impossible. If there is one thing that our current system of government does by having single member districts in the particular form of the presidential system is that third parties are impossible in our system of government. Whereas in most of the rest of the world that has multi-member districts, third parties are inevitable. And so that's one reason why I look so much at the structure of government and see how structure requires certain behavior and makes very difficult to have other behavior. That's the reason I focus on political design in my future teaching and research.
I was long a student of Michael Harrington, and one of his ideas about American politics was that the party structure was more or less irrelevant, that we had such weak parties in America compared to European parties, and that what we really had was a warlord system in the states where different politicians would gather and make alliances with different PACs and groups of money. Do you think that the weakness of the party system is going to give rise to new forms of political organization that would supplant parties?
Yes, I think one of the things that has really already happened is that the political parties are far less salient to the average voter. They still have roles in organizing Congress and doing other things like that. But ideologically, George Wallace said it long ago, there's not a dime's worth of difference between them. And I don't think that there can be. Again, that's a question of our structure, which makes it impossible for either one of the parties to represent anything other than the vested interest, the people that have the most money. That's all they can possibly really be concerned with.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, that was the vision of what the working class party was supposed to be. It was supposed to be the countervailing balance.
That's right, but it can't win. If a left-wing party or a right-wing party or a green party, let's put it that way, that's one that does have some local representation, once it tries to move on the national scene, it is immediately co-opted by one of the other parties and vanishes as a party, or else it takes over from one of the two parties, and then we're back to another two-party system.
Mm-hmm.
So that there are going to be, under our current representative system, always vast areas of unrepresented people who, in one way or another, drop out, either passively or actively, against the current political system. It's a sick system.
You got that right. You probably see it a lot clearer out there from your vantage point in Hawaii than some of us do here.
Well, we don't see it clear, but we certainly see it differently out here. I'm always struck every time I go to the mainland how different things look. I don't think we see it right, but it's just different.
You've written a lot about the Pacific Rim, Japan, and the future of Hawaii. Do you buy into the idea of a Pacific century? Is China and Japan going to dominate our future?
Not necessarily China and Japan, but China and India are.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I see the 21st century dominated primarily by contests, not necessarily conflicts, between a Confucian, primarily Chinese world, of which Japan and Korea are a part, Singapore and Taiwan and so forth, and a Hindic culture, of which India is obviously the dominant, and then a Muslim culture sort of spread horizontally or orthogonally across that, with Western civilization sort of number four.
Mm-hmm. So liberal democracy embodied in Western culture is going to be a weak fourth player there.
Well, I think that that's one of the things that we have to worry about, in a sense. A lot of concern with rights, with individual rights, human rights, civil rights, and so forth, are pretty weakly held in the West. I don't think you'd have a hard time getting the average American to be willing to sign the Bill of Rights now.
Right.
As a political scientist, you know that when we do that in public opinion polls, they say they're not going to touch that communist document.
Exactly, yeah.
And when push comes to shove, there is an awful lot of intolerance. And while people themselves want to be left alone, they're quite eager to interfere with the lives of other people. So I don't think we should glorify its status, although we do have to glorify it, I think, as a principle in the West. But it's not even a principle in much of the rest of the world. And so that kind of liberal democracy might come into existence over the 21st century or beyond, but I don't see it as inevitable.
Do you think that being confronted by those pan-country civilizations that you're talking about will create a greater sense of unity among the Americas and with Europe? The Atlantic Alliance will become more salient?
I think it already is in many ways. Again, one of the things that we see here in Hawaii, because we are a multicultural society, there is no majority ethnic or cultural group here, but rather a wide variety of minorities, that rather than I would not prefer a sort of Western alliance against Asia or all the rest. I hope that the United States would, that white Americans, let me put it that way, would embrace the many different cultures and ethnicities and groups that are already growing in large numbers in their own society, and see this as a strengthening, which I think it is, of the United States and of Western civilization, and by no means a threat.
Again, I'm talking with Jim Dieter. He's a professor of political science at the University of Hawaii and the director of their Future Studies Center there, and the president of the World Futures Studies Federation. I also want to touch on one of my favorite fantasies, which is that the United States would someday participate in something akin to the United the European Union, and we have the inklings of that in NAFTA and some of the other para-NAFTA agreements that have been created in North America. Do you think that there will ever be a trans country democratic body uniting at least North America, or perhaps the whole Americas?
I think that that is a very great possibility. One of the interesting things about the United States at the present time is that it is the only country that doesn't seem to be on the verge of disintegration, and yet it is. If you look at the movements within the South and elsewhere, there's lots of movement towards decentralization and localism within the U.S. And of course, that's one of the things that's characteristic of the European Union. As the European nations are joining together into a larger union, so also are the various ethnic and cultural groups that have been, in a sense, oppressed by the nation states, let's say the Basque or the Catalans or the Welsh or the Irish or the Scots or the, well, you can go on and on and on naming groups. They now feel a greater loyalty towards the European Union than they do to the nation that happens to have captured them as they view it at the present time. So if something like that were to happen in the United States, with a restructuring of Canada and the United States and Mexico and Central America, and then I think ultimately, yes, South America, I really can see a different sort of a union forming. But the basic political form of the 21st century is not going to be geography-based. I think going back to the things we talked about at the very beginning, we have to look at virtual governance and cyberspace as being the place of governance that's going to dominate the 21st century, not geography.
So the sense of citizenship is very central to people's willingness to accede legitimacy to a political institution. And are you suggesting that our participation in virtual community or electronic forms of communication will create a new sense of virtual citizenship that will feel more in common with people on the other side of the planet who share our interests or our associations than people who live next door to us?
Yes, that's true. And I think, again, that you can see that happening in many ways. It's not as dramatic a phenomenon now as it was a few years ago when the internet was new, but the number of intense relationships, romantic and otherwise, that have taken place with people who know themselves only in cyberspace, relationships which in fact often disintegrate when they do meet face to face, indicates that it's a very powerful medium for interpersonal community and interpersonal activities.
Mm-hmm. Another one of your concerns has been the role of the media, and it flows right out of what you're talking about, electronic communication. I would suspect that you would agree somewhat with Chomsky's view of the way that the media functions as a mobilizer of ruling class constraints on the way that we all think and the feeder of certain ruling class perspectives. Do you think that the concentration of the media that's been happening is being counterbalanced by a decentralization through the net, or do you see the net as just another vehicle for ruling class hegemony, or is that the right appropriate terms? Am I putting words in your mouth?
Well, first of all, let me say I agree with Chomsky on almost everything he says, mm-hmm. but I think that the internet at the present time is still contested territory as the economic and political rulers of the world see it as a place to gain control and so forth. They will attempt to, but at the same time I remain still optimistic that it might continue to be a seat of anarchy and creativity and forever not fully able to be controlled by anyone else. So at the present time it seems to me that one of the things that I see is the end of authority, the end of gatekeepers in all aspects of life. That the first to go were librarians, and then newspaper journalists realize their time is over.
Well, the first to go were priests, right? And we got a hold of the Bible.
Priests, oh, priests, absolutely. People are making up all sorts of religions that they would never have thought of if they hadn't run across it in a chat line or a website somewhere.
Right. Yeah, I saw an analysis in Wired, which I don't think by any standard is a revolutionary vehicle, but they did a very Chomsky-esque analysis of the New York Times, and they looked at the New York Times coverage of the net, and they showed that for every positive article that had been published in the Times on the net, there were at least 20 that were negative about child pornography or cryptography.
Absolutely. That's what the media are scared to death with what's happening to their control, and so they're doing as they always do, putting a negative spin on things that threaten them.
You've also written about the topic of artificiality, and I think that this is actually the first place where I saw your name, because I have worked in the past in the field of bioethics, and you've written a number of articles about post-humanism and our slow erosion of what it means to be human and the emergence of robotic citizenship and some other topics. I feel that this may be one of the future divisions politically that will cut across our current left-right continuum, the division between bioconservatives and post-humanists, people who want to embrace these new possibilities. Is that something that you...
Yeah, and I'm definitely on the embraceable side. I don't know whether you have ever heard my name before, Dater, but I happen to not know anything about my own ethnicity, and so I don't know anything about my father or what the meaning or origin of that word was. But I was really delighted when I went to Sweden and discovered that it's the Swedish word for computer.
Oh.
Because I have used that as a reason why I am so interested in post-humanity. Again, I take evolution very seriously, and I see Homo sapiens sapiens as not being the end point of a process, but simply a way station towards the development of true intelligence. And so what we're doing at the present time is creating our own intelligent successors, really intelligent successors, through artificial intelligence on the one hand and genetic engineering on the other.
Now, some people in science fiction circles and in kind of fringe futurist circles would speculate that we're in a race with artificial intelligence, that that if the machines get there first, the machine minds may be so radically different from us and feel no solidarity with their parents, that we may be supplanted, and that therefore we have to upgrade ourselves faster than we upgrade our machines. Do you see that kind of parallel?
Not really. I think that is a possibility, but I think it's the same sort of threat that, say, white people feel about people of color. It's viewed as a threat rather than as a wonderful diversity, and I see no reason why cultures of robots and artificial intelligence couldn't have a similar perspective. Mm-hmm. But let me also say, you know, I do a lot of work with space and teach at the International Space University, and it certainly is the case that so far, biological life seems to be very, very rare, and the universe, the immediate solar system in any event, is not very hospitable place for our kind of life. So it may be that we are evolved on Earth in order to develop life forms which can live in a ecologically ravaged Earth on the one hand, and in a so far lifeless universe on the other. So I think that biological life forms probably don't have a bright future in the long run.
Well, we'll be able to explore space a lot easier in our robotic bodies than...
Absolutely right. Yeah. Absolutely right. Max headroom all the way.
The theme of this show is on the future, and as you'd well know, whenever you talk about the future, everything becomes fodder. You can talk about the future of anything.
Absolutely.
So I could talk to you all night. It's been a very, very great pleasure to talk. Why don't we say one last thing about space?
Okay.
I talk about space a lot on the show as well. And I have yet to come up with a strong, radical, political, or democratic rationale for the space program to answer the critics who say things like, why are we wasting all that money on that when we could be spending it on problems here on Earth? Except to say, and this satisfies my wife, who's an artist, that it's a giant performance art project, that we're going out there just because we can, and it's like wrapping the Reichstag in a white sheet that Christo did. Do you have a more compelling answer for people about why we need to be in space?
I absolutely do not, but I wish I did. One thing I do see, though, is I think the driving force for human settlement of space over the 21st century will not primarily be militaristic as it's been, or even commercial as many people are trying to become, but in order to have a different place to live, a better place to live, that old utopian urge that you were talking about earlier, I think is what's going to ultimately drive us. Just as it's driven at least a portion of all the other humans who have left an old world and gone to a new one. And I think that Mars is just waiting for us.
I really have enjoyed talking with you, Doctor, and I want to direct people to your website at www.soch.hawaii.edu/future/, and that's the Center for the Hawaii Research Center for Future Studies. Do you have any work that's coming out soon?
Well, most of the work that I am doing at the present time, we didn't talk about, is with judiciaries. Mm-hmm. For a variety of reasons, it turns out that judiciaries are the only branch of government in the United States and other common law jurisdictions that are able and, in a sense, required to take the future seriously. And so I continue to do a lot of work with them throughout the United States and throughout the world. Maybe I'd get a chance to see you in Connecticut sometime soon.
Well, that'll be great. I look forward. If you do come, I invite you on the show, so let me know.
Thank you. I'd welcome the chance.
Thank you again for coming on.
Okay. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS-FM at the University of Connecticut in Storrs. If you want to learn more about radical democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about this show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. Also, check out past and future shows and myriad relevant links at the website, www.changesurfer.com.